мною принято решение о проведении специальной военной операции.
We are under attack. It is an attack against Western democracies and on the institutions that bind them.
What Russia is much more interested in doing is depicting the West as a failure.
Regime and President Yanukovych, they were trying to protect their enormous wealth.
This is Kremlin File.
Welcome, everyone, to Kremlin File, and a big, huge welcome to Francis Farrell of the Kyiv Independent, a war reporter, okay, that is keeping us all informed on what is happening on various fronts, not just on the battlefield, but also, you know, at home. Hi, Francis. Welcome.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah, thank you. Especially for giving us your time, Francis, which I know is very precious, okay, these days. Francis, if I remember correctly, you had just come back some time ago, maybe from Bakhmut, if I'm not mistaken, correct? Yeah.
So not from the city itself, because the city limits are occupied by Russian forces, but just from the front line in that area. In Ukraine, they call it the Bakhmut direction, I guess. So from front lines near the flanks, and also just right up against where the city itself is, because since the Russians took it, they took the last streets of this city that doesn't really exist anymore in May. Mm-hmm. Since then, it's actually been the Ukrainians moving forward around that area.
Yeah. What can you tell us a little bit about from your experience there, but I'm sure that you've gone other times, you know, as well. Can you tell us a little bit about the conditions and also the morale of, mm-hmm. you know, the Ukrainian forces and what's happening?
Yeah, it's a good place to start, I guess, because that was my, I guess, strongest impression that I felt that I needed to write about the most from that area. It can get a bit repetitive if you go out on these frontline trips and you just write that this, you know, these soldiers are still fighting as they have been doing for 18 months. But it was an interesting time to go because everyone's watching the counteroffensive, of course, which is going on mostly in the south towards Zaporizhia Oblast. We're all keeping an eye on that, but in Bakhmut, around that area, Ukraine is also moving forward, but unlike the southern front line, where it's a lot of these new brigades that have been trained in NATO countries and equipped with the Western equipment going forward in this super high stakes, all or nothing kind of battle, around Bakhmut, you have the units that have been there for a long, long time. So at least since winter, some of them over a year, just in that one area fighting. So these are really Ukraine's veteran, hardened kind of brigades and units that are fighting there. And they bring a very interesting perspective because they see the war in a very different way to what we see in the news cycle, where we kind of tend to fixate upon big movements back and forth, the big idea of a counteroffensive. Whereas for them, it's true, they have the initiative now. And so there is that optimism. So we're going forward and you know, in a few weeks, in a few months, you know, we could be the ones threatening to take Bakhmut again. But on the other hand, they see it very much not through any kind of rose-tinted goggles in terms of this being the big push and victory is on the horizon or something like that. For them, it's more of the same grind that they've been going through for months. And if, you know, the fact that they're attacking now rather than defending, it doesn't necessarily make their life any easier in the sense. We remember the winter when it was this brutal attack from Russian forces, especially Wagner, these human waves, these prisoner troops moving forward. And defending against that was obviously very hard, but attacking is also hard. It's potentially even harder because you have to go forward against fortified positions, through minefields, and the casualties you take are potentially higher as well. And then you have to hold those positions against counterattacks, against artillery. And so, yeah, for them, it's in a sense business as usual. And you can really feel that in your conversations that you have with the guys there. And as for morale, it paints a very interesting picture about where we are in the war and where we could be in the future, because again, they've been here for months, potentially over a year. Many of them haven't really got a chance to have a rest. Some of them get a chance to get a few days vacation, maybe 10 days. They go back and see their family, maybe less. But their unit as a whole, you would normally expect after that amount of intense fighting that they would be at some point rotated. At some point, they would spend a bit of time in the rear to rest and recuperate. But they haven't had the chance to do that. And that's, maybe you could blame someone for that, but it's also just the reality of what this war is like at the moment, which hasn't got any less intense than it has, since they arrived in this area. So in that sense, a lot of them speak quite openly, we're pretty tired, obviously. Some of them, especially the infantry, who have arguably the hardest job, day in, day out, going and fighting in these trenches, they say, I just really like to go home, I'd really like to have a rest. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, they also say that, we know our job, we know what we signed up for. And so even though, the larger discussions that they're basically solved by the politicians, they're solved by people up there that we don't have mm-hmm. contact with, but we know our job is to be here and fight. If it's to defend, we'll defend. If it's to attack, well, we'll attack. We'll go forward, whatever the orders are. And in that sense, I didn't get any impression of some kind of deep crisis or fatigue. Mm. There was one guy who said, a commander who said, he finds the topic of war fatigue quite absurd, to be honest. It's saying it's the armchair generals, it's the civilians who can't leave the country, who'd want to do something else. They're the ones who are getting tired, but we don't have time to get tired. We'll get tired when the war's over, maybe.
Yeah, that's a lot of people that we talked to, Olga, that we've talked to before. They just, and even some of our friends doing all sorts of different kind of jobs in Ukraine for the war effort and to keep everything going. And they often say, no, who has time to get tired? You just go forward, right? Mm-hmm. And this is what you're doing. Francis, are these the kind of men and women? They come from everywhere. They come from all different walks of life. Is that true?
Yeah, 100%. So I met people literally from all corners of Ukraine, north, south, east and west. Some of them from, young guys from a little village in the Carpathian Mountains, some people from Donetsk itself, who had left back in 2014. And they all have very different perspectives, I guess, of what they're fighting for. But yeah, it's definitely the conversations with those soldiers who are from the occupied territories that they have almost like more resolve and more drive than anyone, because they know that if this is what we're doing, this is what we're going to go forward. I remember just before the counteroffensive started back in May, I met a father and a son, and there were a few of those little pairs of fathers and sons or uncles and nephews in that unit, because it was the local territorial defense unit in Zaporizhia. And so that's on the southern front line where the counteroffensive is really intense at the moment. And they were from this village, which was, I think, about 20 kilometers back from the front line in occupied territory. And so, they don't have anything else to go back to if the war suddenly ends and suddenly the front line gets stuck where it is. They were living peacefully in that village. Then it started. They immediately went to fight. Their village was occupied in the first week or two of the full scale war, and here they are. So yeah, it's always. And people who are from villages, who lived very simple lives in that sense, but also, people who are just very well-traveled, intellectual, people who had businesses overseas and so on, but they still all made the same decision.
Yeah, yeah. I remember seeing a professor teaching from the trenches. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was absolutely incredible. Thinking of the professors that I work with, but just, it hit me because it was something that I could identify with as well.
This is why Ukraine will win.
Yeah.
This is Ukraine will win. And they're not, you see it just from how many from all walks of life who understand what this is about.
Yeah.
Before we move on, you're in Kyiv, and I mean, I have the Air Alert, app, and constantly have it going off. And I mean, Russia's conducting terrorist attacks across Ukraine literally on an hourly basis. Sometimes it's multiple alerts coming through an hour. What is the mood like in Kyiv? How are you? How are you personally holding up and doing your work? And can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so Kyiv in summer is a beautiful place, whether it's wartime and peacetime. And if you look around, if you walk around the streets during summer here, it seems pretty normal. I'm sure you've read that and heard that from people before, talk about. You know, some people like to take advantage of this, and make viral tweets about people in Kyiv partying or going to McDonald's and saying, why are we giving them billions of dollars? But we know how silly that is. On the surface, it looks pretty normal. Obviously, it's a well-known fact that Kyiv is the best defended city when it comes to air defense. So we're lucky in the sense that even if there is a mass missile strike here, it's very, very unlikely that that anyone will be hurt. Some people are hurt regularly, but that's just a few at a time, and most of those missiles get shot down. It was really intense back in May for some reason. They decided to lob missiles at us here basically every day. I remember I was coming to this office one day during, in the middle of the day, in bright daylight. I was on the call for our weekly meeting, which I was trying to get to a bit late. And suddenly I hear explosions. I hear the alarm straight after the explosions. And I look up and I see these, I'm pretty sure they were the Patriot missiles. They were, flying up and one after the other and knocking Russian ballistic missiles out of the sky. And everyone was popping out of their cafes and looking up, some people running in, some people making the stupid decision to film it, which can get you in big trouble here, of course. In the last few months, I would say it's been pretty quiet. About a week ago, there was one more big attack, which woke me up at around 3:30. And a friend of mine, actually, one of the missiles was shot down right over his building. So on one side, his windows were all blown out and cars were on fire and so on. But he was okay because he was on the other side, thankfully. But yeah, personally, for me, when this kind of thing happens, I find it hard to get myself out of bed and go to the metro or something else, I guess, because that's because I have a bit of a different understanding of risk and danger, having been to frontline areas where you hear explosions all the time and there's a much higher level of risk just because of the distance you are to the Russians. So closer you are, the more they can hit you with, and air defense is not going to stop an artillery shell. So I'm quite used to that. You can argue that's a good or a bad thing, that I'm used to it and a bit desensitized. So when it comes to strikes on Kyiv, I'm not too shaken up. But it is, of course, you do sit up and realize when you hear something that is as loud as what you would have heard near Bakhmut or something, and it definitely keeps that in your mind.
Nice. Thank you for that. Now,
hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know ya at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends, so for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcasts, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Hang on. We saw U.S. and Europe delay weapons deliveries, and they were negotiating and going back and forth. Should Ukraine have long-range missiles? Should they have tanks? And literally, it was like a several-month delay until these systems were approved. Over that time, Russia was basically fortifying the front, mining it to the point that, you know, we see that it took extra long for the counteroffensive to kick off. How much of an impact did that delay in the West have to what is happening now? And how much quicker would Ukraine have been able to make advances if not, you know, completely kick Russia out, had these weapons mm-hmm. been delivered on time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very, obviously, one of the, what you bring up is one of the key, I think, things that will be looked back upon when we talk about this war and how it went, the ebb and flow and of the front line of the territory being taken or lost. Of course, when you look at the counteroffensive itself, I guess we can go into more detail later, but you know, it's not only just about blaming the West and not having the necessary number of weapons. That's an important factor, but you can't ignore, you know, the fact that Russia has a say in this as well. It's also a question of how well they defend it, and it's also a question of the strategic decisions made by Ukraine, and some of them may not have been the best ones. But going back to what you originally said, I think that political moment has been almost decisive in many ways. The fact that there was such a delay. Not only a delay, yes, they had a lot of time to politically make that decision and organize, basically motivate their policy of aid to Ukraine by let's give them as much as possible, as quick as possible. The war is 18 months old now, and you think about how long it takes to deliver things, to train Ukrainians and so on. If they'd got real with that very early on, and if Ukraine could have had these capabilities, let's just kind of rewind and think back to last autumn when, you know, September and October, when Ukraine did have a lot of counteroffensive success, not just pushing bit by bit, but really breaking through and taking large amounts of territory. If they had, and that's when Russia was at its weakest as well. Mm-hmm. That's before Russia decided to mobilize. That's before Wagner and their prisoner recruitment happened. That's before their industry started to really kick in and adapt to you know, the reality of what this war is looking like. And so it does make you think, like, what if that decision was made much earlier to give Ukraine tanks and long-range missiles? And you're totally right that there are still things that are being withheld that could be given. And that, again, that's a political decision. And it's a question that I think needs to be asked to the people in Washington, in Berlin, in Paris, everywhere. Like, what is the motivation of your weapons policy to Ukraine? Is it to ensure Ukraine's survival and prevent Ukraine's defeat? Or is it to give Ukraine what it needs to win by taking back all these territories? And it just sounds so simple, but, you know, there's more and more attention being paid to this now because now there are not many more kind of explanations, no excuses in the sense of, oh, we can't send tanks because that's too much. We can't send planes because that would be too escalatory. You know, this idea of red lines and so on. They could have had those concerns, but now they've been proven to be misguided, and we're still not seeing a lot of what could be sent being sent. And there's also, as you said, the delay, the kind of relaxed pace, I would say, all by the books, all following the bureaucracy to slowly, we'll get the dusty tanks out of the warehouse, do all the checks, the price of those decisions are always going to be measured in lives of the Ukrainian soldiers who have to go forward without enough protection, basically.
Yeah.
And Ukrainian civilians who are being under attack.
Of course.
Killed. Yeah, and also the economy. I mean, there are so many aspects, right? This touches every single aspect.
And the psychological.
The Ukrainian statehood.
And psychological. Everything. I mean, I deal with Ukraine on a daily basis. And I mean, I don't know one person who has slept more than a few hours because you're constantly being awoken by air raid sirens. And, sleep deprivation is considered torture. And this is what is happening on a daily basis, and not to mention what's happening with children who hear a thunderstorm and for the rest of their life are going to think that's, bombs coming. Animals, elderly. I mean, it's just even the psychological effect. It's going to take, Ukrainians a very long time to mentally get better after this is finished.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the thunderstorm because that really is what it is. When you hear that, everyone looks around and they have the same, whether they've been close to the front line or not, if you're in Kiev, you've heard these loud explosions, whatever happens. And it's a worry. I mean, people think in Kiev it's pretty safe, but there are still people who really get kind of anxious and panicked by this and will be for a long time. Not to mention what it's like for people who have trauma from being under occupation as well, from being much closer to the front line. People ask me how I'm doing, but even though I've been close, I've honestly been quite lucky not to have anything really nasty happen to me, and I just can't imagine what it's like for people who have. It changes you in a very deep way.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to move maybe closer to the front line, for a moment, Francis. You said something before that Russia was at its weakest in the fall of 2020 and 2022. Sorry about that. 2022 going into the winter. Basically, we wanted to know a little bit about how the troops we had seen and the Russian troops themselves were quite disorganized in the beginning. Then we've seen, as you said, this breakthrough right in the fall of 2022. What is the latest on the Russian, let's say, situation? At the front lines, and has there been an increase or a slowdown of weapons that are getting to them over the past several months?
So it's a good question, and it's one of the biggest unknowns that will potentially decide, where we will stand when this counteroffensive culminates. And, military jargon is this term of culmination. Every offensive has to have a culmination point. Eventually, it happened in the autumn last year, and so that's one of the most important unknowns in terms of understanding how far Ukraine can make it before that point is reached, because we see changes on the map. But that's just a very small fraction of the whole story of what's happening. There's the biggest question, and this counts for both sides as well, is the question of attrition, of of how they're what side has lost how much in terms of personnel, in terms of equipment and ammunition, and how much they'll be able to keep going forward. So with the Russians, again, we have the data from the general staff. Every day they post about Russian losses, and it's debatable about how obviously how accurate that can be, although if you look at it relatively over time, if you look at, for example, the Russian personnel losses that Ukraine posts every day, you can see that it more or less matches up with what we see on the battlefield. So when they were kind of doing these human wave attacks in winter and things were getting really dire, they were losing almost up to 1,000 men, that's dead plus wounded, every day. So now the figures are around 500, 600. So you can tell that from those numbers that there is an increased intensity of Ukrainian artillery fire. You can see how perhaps these new tranche of cluster munitions from the US have been put to use very well by the Ukrainians. We also see over the counteroffensive, we've seen a much higher rate of artillery losses on the Russian side, not just from the general staff data, but from also a lot of videos we see coming in. We see Ukraine using FPV drones and the HIMARS munitions that they've saved up a lot. So there's a method to this, and although, yeah, it's difficult to say the exact casualties of either side at the moment during this counteroffensive, and it's really hard for Ukraine because they're facing not only soldiers but all these mines and so on. You can see that the Russians are suffering losses too. The big question is are those losses high enough, and is the overall kind of damage being done to the Russian side high enough to initiate some kind of collapse, whether it's a local collapse, a rout, or something like that. And it's hard to say at the moment. I'm quite I wouldn't say pessimistic, but just cautious about this. Because for example, we see units occasionally. We see evidence of a paratrooper unit being moved around from one area to another. Mm-hmm. If we talk about the Bakhmut advances that Ukraine's being made, as I said, that's kind of separate in a way from the southern counteroffensive, which is the big strategic push, but it's also done with the aim of drawing a lot of Russian forces away from defending the southern front line. And you could see that effect at the start, but there's always a different possible explanation that you can have for this, a positive one and a negative one. If you see troops being moved from one area to another, it can seem like, oh, they're potentially in a bad shape and they need to plug the gaps here. But another commander in the Bakhmut area, he was saying, well, we've seen a lot of much higher quality Russian units come in to our area recently. And his explanation was that Russia actually felt that they were doing fine in the south and they were holding the Ukrainian offensive pretty well. And so now they had more units to spend in the Bakhmut area. And we see further north in Kupiansk that Russia is attacking as well. And so you at first you think, well, if the situation was so dire for them, then they wouldn't be attacking somewhere else. But then there's another explanation that they're attacking specifically so that Ukraine has to move its reserves to another area to defend. So, again, it's a big unknown. It's very hard to get any kind of reliable data on that. And, you should definitely avoid falling into the trap of seeing a bunch of cool videos of Russians mm-hmm. getting knocked out here or there and thinking that, well, it looks really bad for them, or seeing one video of a soldier who's pretty depressed about its situation, maybe complaining about lack of supplies. Mm-hmm. And that's the one thing I talk about, like just avoid taking these little snippets and vignettes and making conclusions about the overall situation. Again, as I said, that's, I think, the most important thing for how this counteroffensive ends up. For me, the fact that Ukraine's moving forward still and seeming to commit more and they're quite positive about it, it suggests that there's a reason they're doing that. So they see the situation a lot better. They have much better data on where things stand with the Russians, and the fact that they're still moving forward in that southern front line where we know the defenses are at their thickest and most dense, then in a way that's still a good sign for me.
Good. Hopefully it continues that way.
Yeah, we're going to be talking a little bit about the southern front in a bit. Yeah. But I think Olga wanted to ask something about Prigozhin.
Yeah.
What did you want to ask?
So move on, last August, September, when Ukraine began a successful counteroffensive, we saw the fractures happening, specifically with Prigozhin coming out, the Wagnerites attacking defense ministry. And I mean, it pretty much, kept getting more and more serious. You saw a fight on the front lines between the Chechens and the Wagnerites. You saw both killing Russian military personnel who were either trying to escape or surrender. And it, culminated into a rebellion. And basically, we're seeing surrounding the political situation in Russia, the simplest terms, a shit show. And then we see this alleged death of Prigozhin, if he's dead, and the arrest of generals and, other popular military commanders. There was a video floating around recently of General Popov, who basically had recalled his conversation with Gerasimov and had, claimed to have choice of words and has now since apparently been exiled in Syria. So you're seeing, basically, this is not how a country fights a war, when you have so many divisions and factions and, and now we recently heard Russich is leaving. Russich is Russia's Nazi paramilitary group who's been fighting in Ukraine since 2014. They announced they're leaving the Ukraine because of Russia's refusal to get involved with one of the arrested leaders in Finland. Has all of this, has there been any effect on the front lines with Russian troops?
So again, yeah, it's we were all watching the Prigozhin, I don't know what it's called, the mutiny, the rebellion from Kiev.
Soap opera.
Yeah, so with bright eyes, and I think it's fair to say that it ended quite disappointingly. For those in Kiev, I think we just wanted to see a bit of a battle outside Moscow. Even if he had no chance, we just wanted to see one battle. But of course, it's worth remembering that Wagner at that point had been taken off the front lines. Prigozhin had pulled them out of Bakhmut, and as I said, that was the point exactly when they finished taking Bakhmut. But Ukraine also started moving forward on the flanks of the city. And so, it's, you can see that overall Russia's defense of the front line has not fallen apart, has held pretty well, especially in the south, despite the fact that General Popov was, in charge in the south, and he was very vocal about issues that weren't being addressed in the way the whole war was organized in his area. I think at the end, it's worth just looking at the political kind of contest here. And although it seems there are lots of different people with their own kind of agendas, people's main motivation is self-preservation in this area, and that does come out in weakness when you have the rebellion, for example, and you have the fact that the rest of Russia's security organ did not respond and did the way they should. The FSB and the National Guard just kind of rolled over and just
there were bulldozers making holes on the way to Moscow.
Yeah, they were. They sent them out on the road.
They had time to get the bulldozers out, but but that was it. Yeah, I don't really see that they could you know, suddenly fall apart or suddenly become less effective in a way that enables a quick Ukrainian breakthrough anywhere. What I think is interesting in the whole aftermath of the Prigozhin drama soap opera is the removal of Wagner as a fighting force from Ukraine. And it's not really relevant in the context of the summer and the autumn where we expect Ukraine to still have the initiative. But I think it is relevant for the future because, you know, at some point, probably before winter, this offensive would probably have to culminate. And over winter, like last winter, Russia would have their own offensive plans. And last winter, we saw very clearly that, the way that Wagner attacked was the most effective among a lot of very ineffective attempts to take a lot more Ukrainian territory. You saw the Ministry of Defense attack around Kremina in Luhansk Oblast, trying to take back Liman. You saw them lead large-scale offensive around Vukledar, also around Avdiivka, and none of those attempts really went anywhere. They were all beaten off. In Vukledar, it was truly in spectacular fashion. And it was only Wagner with their really special combination, I guess, of experienced, combat-hardened mercenary soldiers and these waves of tens of thousands of people from the Russian prison system that could do some kind of effective job. And before May, before the Prigozhin-Shoigu conflict really escalated, I think there was still a chance for, you know, Prigozhin to once more receive more favor from Putin, for Putin to take stock of the whole situation and see that, well, this guy, at least he could deliver something. And so, you know, let's let him go back and recruit thousands more prisoners. Let's give him more resources, more ammunition. And so then there could have been some kind of scenario in which the Battle of Bakhmut, which was just incredibly brutal, incredibly painful. I think now, looking at the statistics, easily the largest single battle, single engagement anywhere in the world since the Second World War in terms of casualties. If he could repeat that again somewhere else, whether it was Avdiivka or Vukledar or somewhere else, you know, that would have been bad news for Ukraine, and it's probably a good thing that they've been pushed out of the picture now.
Excellent. Good. Bye-bye. Good riddance.
Yep.
Good riddance. Actually, yeah. So, Francis, and where I want to get to in this question is more about the West and the materials that are necessary for Ukraine. You said before that, you know, they should be giving the materials for Ukraine. What, you know, what is the big question here? Yep. You know, what is their strategy, right, in the end, we said before? You've also argued that it should be as fast as possible, correct? How can we actually appeal to European and also U.S. to try to get them to do this? Because, you know, the winter is coming. You're absolutely correct. This is going to be another campaign, a winter campaign. So, first of all, I guess the question is, how can we appeal to the Allied powers so that, you know, they can take maybe a little bit of vantage? We're going to get into, okay, after this question, exactly what is happening on the Southern Front. What do you think? What do you think, Francis?
Personally, I mean, I don't know about a specific public advocacy strategy.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
diplomacy on whose part? I mean, Ukraine, I think, under Zelensky and their diplomats have done a great job so far with what they could do. But I think the overall line of argument for the European population as a whole is first and foremost for them to understand what the nature of Putin's Russia is, and in the sense that it's 100% an aggressive fascist regime, basically filling out all the characteristics of fascism, which is looking to conquer and conquer territory and basically draw those lines, you know, draw the dots and not give any room for some kind of strange realist kind of Russia apologetic propaganda discourses, talking about, you know, how this is our strategic partner, or how that we owe them something for defeating the Nazis in World War II. I mean, obviously, people in Eastern Europe get it. I won't talk about Hungary, but people in Poland and the Baltic states, Czech Republic, Slovakia, you know, they all get it because they remember. They remember what it was like when Russia was strong and Russia just occupied their territories, brought in totalitarianism on the, you know, under a facade of liberation. And I think for Western Europe, they should get it. They just need to look back a little bit further in their history to what that was about. And maybe it's possible for Zelensky and his diplomatic team to focus a little bit more on that parallel. We've written about it here in the Kyiv Independent. Timothy Snyder, of course, has been a very outspoken voice on this. I really just think we should stop being afraid of the word fascism in this sense. You can talk about Russia being a terrorist state. It is. But in a way, that's not that useful, because any country who's ever killed a civilian wrongly can be called a terrorist state, whereas here we're dealing with something a lot scarier and a lot darker.
And to touch on something Francis said, I mean, I've been, sadly, monitoring Russian propaganda for a long time. And I mean, they very clearly have always stated, you know, they wanted Ukraine. The 2014 invasion of Ukraine and illegal annexation of Crimea, those military plans actually leaked in 2008, pretty much around the time after Russia took parts of Georgia, again, occupying. And the thing with Russia is they don't hide it. They have literally, you know, shown on their nightly news, like talk shows, you know, plans of how they're going to take Lithuania, how they could sweep through Estonia, what they're going to do with Slovakia corridor, how they're going to take Moldova. So Russia's telling you that Ukraine is, you know, right now their objective, but when we're done with Ukraine, then we're going to move on and take Moldova and take this and, you know, and whatnot. So it's like they're telling you, they don't hide it. Just like here in the West, everyone's, you know, haggling, is it genocide, not genocide? Russia's telling you very clearly, we need to wipe out every single last Ukrainian that exists. And that's it. Destroy the it's not a culture. There's no history there. It's all made up. It's fake. Burn all the books. Kill every single Ukrainian. And here people are like, well, do you think Russia really wants genocide? I mean, they're telling you this.
They've changed their history books.
But they're changing Ukrainian history books.
Exactly.
And they're taking Ukrainian children and brainwashing them to basically erase their ethnicity and to make them, you know, Russian. And that's it. And I mean, it's sickening. And the thing is that the West really needs to wake up, because Russia is telling everyone what they're going to do. They told everyone pretty much, I mean, at least anyone who monitored that, what was going to happen with Georgia, what was going to happen with Ukraine. They broadcast everything. And people.
Another thing that popped up once or twice, maybe more times on those ridiculous shows. And of course, you know, it's, you do remember it's a bit of a circus, but you just see that mentality that they that they have. One thing that they mentioned, you know, something about ceasefire and negotiated ceasefire, and I think it was Simonyan who said on one of these shows, you know, of course, you know, of course, if there's a ceasefire, it's just going to be so we have enough time to prepare and go again. Like she just said it herself. Like,
yeah.
Anyway.
Snowflake blocked me on Twitter, I think it was a few years ago, because I called her beast in Russian. And she blocked me right away. No, but that's the thing, that they tell you what they're doing, they tell you what they're going to do. And I mean, frankly, this goes back to the Soviet Union and how they treated, you know, countries that they occupied and whatnot. Now, getting to the counteroffensive. We have heard recently that Ukraine is making significant breakthroughs in several locations in the south, that they're making gains in Zaporizhia region. What do you see happening, and where do you think is it going, and is it going to be pretty much a repeat of what we saw last September, where Ukraine was able to take back a lot of territory in lightning speed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so first of all, I think one should drop expectations of that kind of repeat, because it's just a completely different operation, completely different terrain, and a completely different enemy with a lot way better prepared. We know about these defensive lines, we know about these minefields. So what happened, for example, in Kharkiv was just not possible when you can't, you know, just pierce through and take huge amounts of territory, because there are more lines of trenches and minefields, and Russia has prepared for half a year for this exact moment, whereas back then there was the whole deception of with Kherson, and they really did well to target an area where Russia wasn't expecting anything at all. So yes, in that sense, we're at a very interesting time, I would say, in the counteroffensive, in the sense that we have these three axes. So we have the two in the south, Orikhiv, Robotina, then you have Velika Novosilka, and then you have the area around Bakhmut, which is could be described as more of a fixing operation, as I mentioned earlier. It's pretty clear now that Ukraine is committing to for the Orikhiv area, Robotina area, to be the main push. So that's where we've seen the most developments recently. And that comes as no surprise, because strategically that's the biggest prize, you know, to cut through to these cities of Tokmak and Melitopol, cut off the Russian connections to Crimea, and so on and so forth. But that's also where the Russian defenses are the most dense and thick and strong as well. And so for many months, well, since the start of the counteroffensive, progress has been territorially very slow. It was just last week that they wrapped up the capture of this one village, Robotina, which was the first village on that sector of the front line that basically came under attack. And now, the reason I say we're at a very interesting time is because we see them pushing further. And if you look on the map, we know exactly where these, you know, big defensive lines are, because we can see them from the south. Mm-hmm. So all the people that make their maps, you can click a button and you see where they are. And right now we see the early defensive lines around Robotina have been breached, but now they've come up against probably what can be called the main line of this complex, the Surovikin line, or whatever you want to call it. And that's what Ukraine is looking to breach. Now, I don't really like the word breakthrough in this sense, because, you know, of what I said earlier, it's like a breakthrough. You feel like that's going to be the, I know this word in Russian, the perelomny, this kind of real, you know, this is where everything changes kind of moment. Whereas we know that these defenses have been designed so that an early breakthrough doesn't become a large strategic breakthrough. So they've pushed past this line, or they're on the brink of pushing past it, which is a very interesting moment to watch, because now they could build on that. They could kind of widen this bulge of territory that they've taken. They could take more of this line, you know, instead of breaking through it, they could move along it, which might be easier. And if they can do that, then it will be a huge step towards getting something out of this counteroffensive that can really be called a success, because then they could get a lot closer to Tokmak. And if I think if we're speaking in 3-4 months time and Ukraine has liberated Tokmak, that will be huge, and it will be a sign that this was all worth something. So definitely next few weeks will be very interesting to watch. I just don't want to speak too soon or pretend I understand what I don't, because again, what's probably more important, as I mentioned earlier, is the state of attrition of both sides. So, you know, the fact that we know how this has been costly for Ukrainian units. I think it is fair to say that some of the reserve units that were committed earlier than they would have liked to, because they would have preferred to use them to exploit a breakthrough rather than, you know, that requiring that muscle to just make that breach in the first place. And it can be argued that it maybe wasn't a great decision to rely so much on these new brigades, because maybe months and months of combat experience is more important than having a couple of shiny Leopard tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles. But that's something that, you know, the real experts will figure out when we see the end of this counteroffensive. And what's more important is what's going on the Russian side, as we mentioned. So the attrition that's been taken there, are they in a place where they can keep committing more reserves? Do they have that ability to contain, to potentially use the time to build more lines of defense further back? So, what I can say for sure is that it's an important time right now. The next few weeks of fighting will say a lot. I think by the end of September, we'll figure out basically where we stand with this counteroffensive. But again, I'll repeat that just the fact that there has been this progress in an area that has been pretty much stalled for a long time, this recent progress, it speaks a lot to me. It says that they feel like there's a good reason to still push forward, because that's and I've written about this before, one of the big differences between the way Ukraine and Russia fights this war is first of all, the grasp of reality. So you don't have a dictator at the top who's demanding victory from a military that cannot deliver it but has no choice. And on top of that, the value of human life, I think, is definitely something where you see a big contrast between the two sides. It doesn't need to be explained. And in that sense, you know, these Leopard tanks and Bradley infantry fighting vehicles have been very valuable. We've seen evidence, we've seen data about how they protect their crew a lot more. And that's something that's valued here. It's not something that's valued in the Soviet-Russian way of war, but compared to these Soviet armored vehicles, you know, it is good to see that people more or less, even if they lose the vehicle, they come out of the battlefield alive.
Yeah, we've seen some footage about that. Just to follow up on what you're saying, Francis, Ramstein is coming up, no, in the next, what is it, September the 18th. Are they going to be talking about, you know, what is necessary, obviously, for Ukraine and that kind of thing? Do you have any word at all on it?
So things to keep an eye out on, I think it looks like we may be getting close to Germany announcing the Taurus long-range missiles, which are similar to the French and English Storm Shadows, but actually better, longer range. So it'll be interesting to see what Ukraine can do with that. I still don't understand why the American attack MS long-range missiles haven't been provided yet. It's the biggest no-brainer in my view. But even with those things, you know, again, it's you have to be cautious about expecting those kind of systems to completely change the game. We know Ukraine's gotten better. They're developing their own long-range missiles and drones, and they've been starting to use them pretty well. But from what I can tell you honestly, in the war at the moment, the most important resource and weapons are shells, maybe drones as well, and people. The kind of battles that we're seeing, the kind of wars that we're seeing, that's the most important thing. Of course, tanks and you know, helicopters, planes, long-range missiles, logistics, they're all very important. But just when it comes to that brutal numbers game, that war of attrition, that's the most important thing.
Okay, so drones, shells, and people. Speaking of which, before I let you, Olga, okay, wrap this up, in early June, okay, we saw a secret and very strange, can we call it that, joint operation. It was carried out between Hungary and Russia. I don't know if you have any information on this. It was 11 Ukrainian soldiers that, after being held in captivity, okay, for an unknown amount of time, were then moved from Russia to Hungary.
Did do a little joint investigation with a colleague from Radio Free Europe about some of the more some of the more murky details about that. It was a bit after the story had died down in the news cycle, which was a shame because it was so many questions left unanswered. How could this have happened? And the Hungarian government kind of got away with pretending that they didn't have a role in this, where it was just impossible in every way possible to not have a role. And it was announced by the deputy prime minister, the second most powerful, after Orban in the country, saying that, yeah, we did it, I did it, and the Maltese church helped with logistics. And then out comes the foreign minister and said, no, this was an agreement between the two churches and we had nothing to do with it. So again, it's just, I mean, it's not a surprise when it comes to Hungary having the motivation to do this. I think the conclusion to our piece was that obviously they were definitely involved, and they probably had an idea in their minds that they could spin this as some kind of political win, where Budapest is playing the role of mediator, of negotiator, and also helping the Hungarian minority people in Ukraine, which has always been a sticking point for them.
Yeah.
But they lost control of the narrative, and very quickly they were in damage control because everyone else looked around and said, this is ridiculous that you had a role in this whatsoever. And they just denied it, and slowly the story died down. I think at one point the Ukrainian spokesman for the military intelligence said that they had information that they were planning a second such transfer, but I think maybe that was in the works, but I think that the way it was reacted to, not at all positively, probably turned them off that idea.
No. Unlike the Pope, who doubled down, by the way, on his remarks. But anyway, let's skip ahead.
Yeah.
I hear Hungary, I hear the Pope, and it's a mirror. I don't understand why.
Yeah. We'll put up the story on our show notes, and when it comes to Hungary, it's Putin's puppet, Orban. Yeah. So yeah. I expect everything and anything from him. He's getting very close to being Lukashenko. So, yeah. And I actually am worried, and something to monitor going forward towards our elections. I'm worried how that Hungary will be used as a point of attacks on U.S. elections and elections across Europe. Russia in 2016 did it from themselves using their operatives. 2020 decided to shift to Ukraine, use their Russian agents inside of Ukraine, and now I'm worried that we're going to see Hungary for 24. Yeah. To wrap this up, there are discussions of F-16s. It looks like they're finally going to be sent a year and a half after the fact, but it looks like they're getting their USS committed to training F-16 pilots. We've had several European countries who said they will deliver F-16s. How much of a difference will it make on the battlefield? Will Ukraine be able to get control of their airspace and disrupt Russian attacks? And then lastly, last winter, we saw Russia's strategic terrorist, you know, strategy of specifically targeting power plants and making sure that Ukrainians are left without water and heat and electricity in the coldest, most brutal, you know, days of winter. Do you see Russia repeating this strategy this year? And do you think Ukraine is better prepared to protect itself this year than it was last year?
So on F-16s, I think it's not a very, I would say, eccentric opinion to say that it's not really going to impact the battlefield in the short term. We know how long this takes. We know Denmark's plan of giving a few at the end of this year, a handful more next year, and a handful more in 2025. And so far, it's Denmark, Netherlands, Norway has said they'll give some, but we don't know details yet. So this is a long road, and it's a long road for Ukraine's air force, which has been obviously very, very badly mangled by this war, although it's still functioning. I saw planes outside Bakhmut, which was nice to see. I'm pretty sure they were ours. I am sure. But it's a long road, and at the moment, Ukraine still, its military still fights using a Soviet-style doctrine based on land warfare, based on artillery, armored vehicles, and infantry. And so, again, you have the qualitative kind of news that you see, but if for a need for it to make an impact, it needs to be quantitative. So it's still going up against the Russian Air Force with hundreds and hundreds of fighter aircraft. And it's also worth remembering about Russia's air defense capabilities. So Ukraine, so far in this war, has done a pretty good job of keeping the Russian Air Force, this huge Russian Air Force, out of the fight in Ukraine, thanks to its own air defense, much of which at the start, now it's slowly being replaced, but much of which at the start was just a legacy of the Soviet era air defense systems, which Ukraine had. So if you imagine if Ukraine's air defense was enough to keep the Russian Air Force out of the fight, Russia's air defense will probably, Russia's air defense and air force together will probably be enough to limit the impact of and prevent Ukraine from being turning into the kind of military in which air power is a big part of the way they fight. So in that sense, F-16s are important for keeping Russia's air force mostly out of the fight, for them to not be able to fly around freely. And it's something to look forward to, but not something I think we can expect to make a huge difference very soon. As for the winter mass missile strikes, yes, it's on everyone's mind. Everyone's kind of preparing for it mentally and physically. I see here in our office we've brought out our big power banks and power stations ready for that kind of eventuality. And like the civilian population will definitely be better prepared. But the big question is, of course, the energy infrastructure itself. And there's two kind of sides to that. There's apart from what Russia decides to do, I think everyone is in agreement that they will do the same thing again. Then it's a question of the state of the energy infrastructure, because unfortunately, although they've done incredible work to keep it all online and get it going pretty well, basically as soon as the mass attacks finished, it hasn't gone back to full capability. And we don't know, it's very hush-hush strategic facility things. We don't know exactly what the state of the infrastructure is, but it's not 100%. So, Russia has less to destroy, I guess, in an attempt to cripple it. Again, I don't think they will, but then there's also a question of air defense, which is another tricky one, because a lot of Ukraine's air defense is still using Soviet air defense systems, which use Soviet air defense missiles, which Ukraine doesn't produce and can't really produce because they're quite complex and they're only produced in Russia. And so we've got more air defense from the West, and Ukraine's gotten better at shooting down the Iranian drones, which are specifically designed to, in big swarms, kind of overwhelm and exhaust Ukrainian air defense. So it's going to be a new battle in the skies. I think it's fair to say that Ukraine won the battle last winter. They kept their grid up and running. People more or less learned to deal with the outages, and they came out in spring, pretty much fine. But there's going to be another one this winter. I think everyone's pretty sure about that. And it's going to be a bit of a different numbers game, but let's hope they can do the same.
Yeah. So Francis will be looking out for, let's say, the next few weeks, what you've been talking about and all of this information, and we'll see what the next few weeks brings, right? This is going to be a fundamental moment, I think, between everything, and then how the winter also wraps up as well. Olga, did you want to add something before we?
No, I think we actually covered everything. I just wanted to thank you for your time. Hopefully you'll come back and join us. Hopefully, as we see more results what's happening on the front lines, and hopefully, Russia's front lines will collapse.
Yeah.
And I think, mostly, I think I will just repeat Francis's, very important statement that the U.S. and Europe must stop saying we're going to support Ukraine for as long as it takes and switch their thinking that we're going to do as fast as possible to get everything that is there so we can end this war. And so there's, an ending, because right now, long as it takes, decades, years, months.
Yeah, what are we talking about?
Exactly. So, Washington, if you're listening, Washington and Germany, speed up the delivery systems. Yep. Let's wrap this up. Let Ukraine, get its country back
as quickly as possible. Exactly. That's right. For regeneration and reconstruction, right? Which is necessary.
Yeah.
Thank you, Francis. Thank you.
No worries. Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you for the work you're doing. And stay in touch, definitely. And let me know if you come to Kiev.
Great.
Okay. Have a great day.
Hi, everybody. If you enjoyed this podcast and you'd like to help us out with our independent work, please subscribe to Kremlin File on Substack and on our YouTube channel. Kremlin File is hosted by Olga Lautman and me, Monique Kamara. Our production team is headed by Maddie Kaparov, and the theme music by Oreste Kamara. So please don't forget to visit our Kremlin File Substack for links to our socials and to wherever you'd like to listen to podcasts.